government puppets all echo their will. So smug while we swallow their fork-tongued pills.
And they make and we are back. About things being so this bad. Is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. Welcome. This is Deanna. And this hour, I'm going to give you some information about what I call the Pledge of Obedience. Now, I'm probably going to make some people mad, but if you actually think about the information that I'm going to present and go through it and recognize where certain things originated, then you're going to probably target somebody else with your anger. Catastrophic circumstances in America, such as Lincoln's War, World War I and II, or more recently the horrific events of September 11th, 2001, function as transitory events. Members of Congress and the powers behind the scenes quickly pass legislation that the traumatized citizens would never accept under ordinary circumstances. In an environment of insecurity, chaos, and uncertainty, citizens invariably look to the government officials for solutions to the calamity that has befallen them. This is incongruous, given that many of these politicians are verifiably corrupt. Yet, many citizens repeatedly place unwarranted trust in these same unscrupulous characters. The newly enacted legislation consistently imposes restrictions on the citizens. Obviously, the target of the events of that day, meaning September 11th, while it increases government power coupled with more stringent law enforcement. So basically, the citizens were the targets of that event, and yet they are also the targets of the legislation. Almost exactly 150 years ago, as I write this or as I talk about this, the calculated chaos that emerged because of Lincoln's War predictably fractured America. Officials opportunistically used that cultural rupture to compel citizens, literally at gunpoint, to accept the centralization of government power in Washington at the expense of states' rights. If the South surrendered and abolished slavery, that region of the country could only return to the Union if a certain percentage of the Southern citizens swore a loyalty oath. On December 8, 1863, a year and a half before the end of the war, Lincoln confidently issued the Proclamation of Amnesty. People referred to it as the 10% Plan of Reconstruction. It read, and I quote, "A rebellion now exists whereby the loyal state governments of several states have for a long time been subverted, and many persons have committed and are now guilty of treason against the United States," unquote. Those treasonous individuals were subject to the confiscation of their private property. He said that if just 10% of the people who voted in 1860 within each state would take a loyalty oath to the federal government, then that state could, and I quote, "reestablish a state, a government, which should be Republican and in no wise contravening such oath," unquote. Now, there was radical Republicans in Congress that felt that the demands placed upon the South were too lenient and favored an even stronger, more ironclad oath. Lincoln said that those who participated in the existing rebellion were guilty of treason. The government would restore their property, accept their slaves only if they swore an oath of allegiance to the Union. Various individuals proposed suitable oaths, some more severe than the one that they finally chose. Okay, we're going to a break. We'll be right back. And we are back. That is a new song. It's called Peace. and it's by Steve Doerr. The federal government compelled the vanquished Southerners to swear allegiance to an escalating, powerful, centralized government. Officials used additional clever mechanisms to secure strict loyalty and emotionally unite the remainder of an inherently diverse population of independent farmers, people who had left or lost their land and were now urban factory workers, and recent immigrants. The government wanted every citizen to unite under a common purpose. Gradually, the federal government suppressed individuality, a natural and acceptable consequence of one's lifestyle, experiences, and opportunities. Certain individuals with questionable motives used the concept of exceptionalism, that idea of being the chosen people, only to garner support for a more powerful, centralized government. Persuasive individuals used deceptive devices such as emotion-packed words and phrases, personified flags, powerful symbols, soul-stirring anthems, and even religious-oriented hymns. Michael A. Hoffman, one of my favorite authors, justifiably claims that flattery is the first principle of mind control. He wrote, and I quote, "This is the first secret of mass mind control and can be observed as the foundation stone of virtually every philosophy, system, and training. The American masses are told that they are free and highly educated when, in fact, we are debt slaves to the demonic, greedy money powers." It was true following Lincoln's war, and it is even more applicable now. People ingrain American exceptionalism, a stepsister of arrogance and self-righteousness, through symbolism and songs that promote our self-importance. Radio host Michael Medved, who is on the mass media, is a pro-war propagandist, and in an example of this exclusivity, reminds his listeners on a daily basis that the U.S. is the greatest nation on God's green earth. Early songs that promoted patriotism, the last refuge of a scoundrel, include John Brown's Body, a famous Union Army marching song that had nothing whatsoever to do with the abolitionists, but was a tune somebody adapted from the American camp meeting movement of the 1800s. Julia Ward Howe, a fervent abolitionist, wrote lyrics for the tune in November 1861 that editors close to her family published and popularized in the Atlantic Monthly on February 1, 1862, as the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Abolitionist Harriet Beecher Stowe, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr., John Greenleaf Whittier, and James Russell Lowell co-founded the Boston-based magazine in 1857. And many of those people were actually tied to the Illuminati. With the exception of Stowe and Whittier, they either attended or taught at Harvard University. Howe's lyrics subtly associate Christianity with killing and warfare. This song promotes the idea that war is a Christian's effort to rid the world of evildoers. Christians are supposed to eliminate the evil within, not kill evildoers targeted by ethnically challenged political leaders. Author John Remington Graham wrote that after the Union soldiers had torched Atlanta on November 11, 1864, per their scorched earth policy during William T. Sherman's murderous march to the sea, a band played the Battle Hymn of the Republic as defenseless women and children, now homeless, fled into the countryside. Sherman writes in his memoirs, and I quote, "Never before or since have I heard the choir, the chorus of Glory, Glory, Hallelujah, done with more spirit or in better harmony of time and place," unquote. In 1865, Cambridge-educated Sabine Baring-Gould wrote Onward Christian Soldiers, another song that links Christianity and mass killing. The music was from a famous Freemason marching hymn. Sir Arthur S. Sullivan, an English composer who studied at Leipzig Conservatory, composed the music. He was a Freemason and a grand organist in the Grand Lodge of England. Nearly 80 years later, on August 14, 1941, warmongers Winston Churchill and Franklin D. Roosevelt, both high-level Freemasons, met on the battleship HMS Prince of Wales to formalize the Atlantic Charter, a blueprint for shaping the world after yet another cataclysmic war. Afterwards, Prime Minister Churchill chose Onward Christian Soldiers, a very subtle musical selection to associate, to connect Christianity to warfare. Soul-stirring lyrics set to inspiring music constitute a very powerful medium which is used to introduce and ingrain desired emotions. Music can inspire, instruct, and indoctrinate in a very indirect, unobtrusive way, and has long been used to impact individuals in both positive and negative ways. Music kindles predictable emotions and effectively stimulates or alters one's disposition. A movie without background music does not arouse the desired emotions sought by filmmakers. Think about it. Considering music's impact, it is important to evaluate how and why producers and directors use music the way that they do in particular circumstances. Is the song or music appropriate to the occasion? What motivates a questionable musical choice and who made that choice? Francis Scott Key, a Freemason. You'll note that a lot of Freemasons are involved in warfare. A Freemason and brother-in-law to Roger B. Taney, then Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, wrote the poem that became even more compelling and influential after someone set it to music, The Star-Spangled Banner, with its rockets, red glare, and bombs bursting in air, reminiscent of the shock and awe explosions of the world wars in Baghdad and in Baghdad in March 2003. John Stafford Smith, some years earlier, wrote the music that Key used for his poem. Smith, an English Freemason, belonged to the Inverness Lodge No. 4 in London. The music was adapted from a song called To Ancyron in Heaven, a popular drinking song in the local pubs. The music was, at one time, used by an Irish Masonic Orphans Home as their song. The Navy adopted the song for official use in 1889. President Wilson ordered the song to be played on military occasions. Congress decreed it as our national anthem on March 3, 1931, signed into law by President Herbert Hoover, a longtime Rothschild asset. Since World War II, and most especially since 1980, the anthem has been performed prior to sports events, especially before the beginning of most MLS, NBA, NFL, MLB, and NHL games. It is also part of the pre-race ceremony in every NASCAR race. A huge, enthusiastic audience, a bigger convergence of people than in most other settings, is a perfect environment to generate patriotic fervor through the emotionalism of the national anthem. It becomes a collective experience which psychologically binds the masses to the will of the government. There is similarity and interchangeability between sports and military rhetoric. Author Jabe Kujiman points out that coaches use, oftentimes, military metaphors to plan strategies. Military officials, politicians, and journalists often refer to sports when discussing military operations. The same author wrote, and I quote, "A national identity can be reinforced through the patriotic sentiments of war, and sports events can bring national communities together in patriotism and nationalism," unquote. People have established a verbal connection between militarism and sports. Thus, without any resistance or commentary, individuals, not inadvertently, inextricably merged sports and military supremacy. The U.S. Flag Code states that during the presentation of the national anthem, when the flag is displayed, all except those in uniform should stand at attention, facing the flag with the right hand over the heart, a renewal of one's allegiance. This is sinisterly similar to the sign of the hidden hand of the men of Jabulon, a symbolic or ceremonial name used as password by Royal Ark Masons, which men execute by placing the right hand inside his jacket, indicative of his oath of allegiance. Many, some of whom are or were Freemasons, include Karl Marx, Napoleon, Lenin, Solomon Rothschild, Theodore Roosevelt, Frederick August Bartholdi, William T. Sherman, and hundreds of others have exhibited the Jabulon gesture. We're going to break, and we'll be back after a few words from our sponsors. Okay, we are back. Religious-like devotion to one's nation is not spontaneous, but is methodically managed by politicians, social scientists, theologians, financiers, and an expanding jingoistic press. Author Guido Preparata argues that American patriotism during World War II and gung-ho love of one's country was not love at all, but the ready call to hurt the enemy, whoever he was, wherever he lurked, anyhow, anytime, in a wave of this induced collective dementia and a new idolatry of the red, white, and blue, American pride, and the Star-Spangled Banner. People relinquish individualism in favor of comfortable conformity and herd instinct consensus, seduced by waving flags, images of soaring eagles, marching bands, parades of faceless uniformed people, vows and pledges, and salutes to supposed superiors. Experts behind the scenes carefully manage group thinking. Edward Bernays, nephew of Sigmund Freud, was the intuitive, manipulative father of the public relations or professional propaganda industry. He always harnessed the private interest of his elite clients to public interest. In other words, getting people to buy or act in a certain way that financially benefited his patrons. The best way to alter society is to finance and control trusted institutions like the churches, the schools, and persuasive and influential theologians and educators. In 1880, Francis Bellamy, a Freemason, graduated from the Rochester Theological Seminary and became a minister. In November 1899, John D. Rockefeller gave $150,000 to this seminary, headed by a Rockefeller crony, Augustus Hopkins Strong. This was one of numerous donations that Rockefeller made to this institution. Bellamy, a Northern Baptist, was an ardent Christian socialist who preached socialism, rejected the Bible, and denied the deity of Jesus. He visited the South for a brief period and observed that residents were closely tied to traditional Christianity and showed little hope of adopting progressive ideas like evolution. The South's connection to Christianity was one of its biggest distinguishing factors as opposed to the North's materialistic, socialistic mentality. Perhaps that mentality helped to make the region a target for the bankers. Edward Bellamy, Francis's cousin, studied Prussian socialism and language in Dresden in 1868, 1869, and visited Germany again in 1887. He wrote a novel entitled Looking Back, 2000 to 1887, published in January 1888. Editors translated his book into over 20 languages, including German. It sold millions of copies in America, second only to Marx's Das Kapital in 1867. People viewed his book as the most influential book published in the previous 50 years. He promoted a Gilded Age government-imposed utopian alternative to the money powers and corporatism. In 1890-91, devotees formed at least 165 Bellamy clubs throughout America. Members wanted to create a classless society and crusaded for a government takeover of the economy as Bellamy envisioned. Interestingly, George H.W. Bush, with similar goals, wrote a book exactly 100 years later entitled Looking Forward. Columbia University educated Daniel D. Leon, a newspaper editor, Marxist theoretician, and leading figure in the U.S. Socialist Labor Party, applauded Bellamy's efforts. Julius A. Whalen of Kansas, the editor of the party's leading national newspaper, Appeal to Reason, wrote, and I quote, "Bellamy was one of the few men who had not lived in vain. Since Looking Backward popularized socialism, made it interesting, and started millions to thinking along lines entirely new to them," unquote. Eugene V. Debs praised his wonderful work, and I'm quoting, "his wonderful work because he brought to the limited intelligence of the average practical man a picture of the practical workings of socialism," unquote. In 1898, the Social Democratic Party passed a resolution reaffirming that Bellamy's work was the most effective undertaking that had been accomplished for socialism in the United States. The French socialist, Jean Jaurès, considered Looking Backward an American masterpiece that did wonders toward dissipating hostile ignorance against our ideas, unquote. Bellamy's novel is the story of Julian West, a young Bostonian who awakes in 2000 from a hypnotically induced sleep which began in 1887. The novel describes America's future as a regimented workers' paradise where everyone has equal incomes and are appropriately educated in patriotic, government-run schools, and then, following universal military service, are drafted into the country's industrial army at the age of 21. We'll be back after a word from our sponsors. Okay, so Bellamy's novel is the story of Julian West, and he wakes up after going to sleep, and he was induced into a sleep, and he wakes up in the year 2000, and the novel describes America's future as a regimented workers' paradise where everyone has equal incomes and are appropriately educated in patriotic government-run schools, and then, following universal military service, are drafted into the country's industrial army at the age of 21, where they serve in state-assigned jobs out of a possible 200 or 300 diverse trades and avocations. West perceived, on waking, that the nation's wealth, the production and distribution of resources, were now in the possession and control of a few people. The state, in the beginning of the 20th century, without violence or bloodshed, had seized jurisdiction over all industrial enterprises and combined them into one gigantic trust, which the government managed for the benefit of all of its citizens. Okay, so that was his novel. Edward Bellamy founded Boston's first Nationals Club. In January 1889, the club members adopted their Declaration of Principles, which incorporated Helen Blavatsky's Mystical Theophist Doctrines and Sidney Webb's Fabian Socialist Economic Theories. In April 1891, Francis Bellamy, Vice President of the Christian Society of Socialists, an auxiliary of Bellamy's nationalist movement, worked for Daniel Ford's Boston-based Youth's Companion magazine. He worked with Ford's nephew, James Bailey Upham, a Knights Templar, the equivalent of a 33rd degree Scottish Rite Mason. Upham was a member of the Converse Lodge in Malden, Massachusetts. They increased the magazine's circulation by selling inexpensive U.S. flags to public schools, institutions already influenced by socialist John Dewey. In support of the schoolhouse flag movement, they intended to place a flag above every school. In conjunction with this flag distribution program, Bellamy chaired the National Public School Celebration for Columbus Day under the direction of the National Education Association, later under the control of the Rockefeller Foundation. Officials initially designed the flag to be flown at federal installations. Because of the contemporary Department of Education, officials consider all public schools as authorized federal institutions. To augment the schoolhouse flag movement and incorporate socialism as viewed by Edward Bellamy, his illustrious cousin Francis wrote a pledge in which each student pledged his or her total devotion to the state. He published his creation in the magazine on September 8th, 1892. Now remember, Francis is a dedicated socialist. And he published this pledge, and it read, and I quote, "I pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands, one nation indivisible, with liberty and justice for all," unquote. While pondering on this oath, he related to friends, and I quote, "With the meaning of the war between the states, with the aspiration of the people, it is the concise political word for the nation, the one nation which the war between the states was fought to prove. To make that one nation idea clear, we must specify that it is indivisible," unquote. The Bellamys enthusiastically admired Lincoln for his aggressive warfare against the rebellious South. Now, this is where it gets very interesting. Karl Marx, who wrote the Communist Manifesto, suggested that the very first objective in setting up a communist nation was in demanding and establishing, and I quote, "a single and indivisible republic," unquote. Marx's use of the word republic actually means a socialistic democracy. The indivisible republic was the overriding principle of the illuminated French Jacobinism. The nation that is indivisible. In other words, cannot be divided. Cannot be divided. It is centralized. It is powerful. It is invincible. Essentially, advocates for a strong central government forcibly seized power from local government entities and transferred it to federal tyrants in an undeviating and permanent indivisible entity, a power that they would never again relinquish to the individual sovereign states and their citizenry. In 1892, after the media popularization of Bellamy's Looking Backward, the enlightened cousins discussed universal brotherhood, another Illuminati objective that prompted Francis to embody the ideals of equality and fraternity into the pledge, ideas that people carried to America from the French Revolution. He incorporated the phrase, and I quote, "with liberty and justice for all," unquote. Upham and our socialist friend Bellamy particularly wanted to emphasize the word allegiance. They wanted the pledge to be a heartfelt vow, not just a salute. The Bellamy cousins venerated Lincoln and his violent revolution, so the word allegiance was significant and essential. Southerners negatively associated the pledge with and I quote, oath of allegiance that they had to take, a vow that they, that really compelled them to swear an oath to the invaders who destroyed their culture and their existence. Others, including church leaders, also had misgivings about swearing an oath. The Catholic Church had serious qualms about swearing an oath, one of the issues they also had against Freemasonry. Francis Bellamy devised a ritualistic straight-arm salute, the whole ritual to be directed by a school principal. Of course, that principal was under the federal government. The pupils stand, lift their right arms toward the flag, palm downward, and then recite the pledge. After the recitation, students were often instructed to say, and I quote, one country, one language, one flag, unquote. The straight-arm salute, per congressional edict, was abandoned in December 1942 after the Nazis adopted it. School administrators used the pledge and salute as part of the National Public School celebration on Columbus Day, October 12, 1892. The Rockefeller-financed NEA promoted the national adoption of the pledge and the placement of the American flag in every government-run classroom. Parochial schools did not adopt the program. Advocates urged senators, congressmen, and other politicians to promote the proposed celebration for Columbus Day. Theodore Roosevelt, a member of the U.S. Civil Service Commission, remarked, and I quote, the common school and flag and to stand together as the archetypical of American civilization, unquote. Grover Cleveland, in the process of campaigning for the presidency, asked U.S. Representative Henry Cabot Lodge to arrange for President Harrison and Congress to support the approaching celebration. The government sought to finance mandatory public schools, an idea generally opposed by the majority of the populace because they viewed public schools as socialistic. Harrison issued a statement requesting that the population to honor the 400th anniversary of Columbus with festivities at their schools or other public places. Now, Columbus, I know he's been whitewashed and painted as some sort of hero, actually was a mass murderer, but that's another radio program. Francis Bellamy attended a flag raising ceremony in New Jersey on April 25th, 1893, the first event at which adults recited the Pledge of Allegiance. James Upham and Francis Bellamy led the recitation, saying, and I quote, the times demand a patriotic citizenship, patriotic schools, a patriotic pulpit, a patriotic press, unquote. Bellamy, in favor of government-run schools, wrote in the Youth's Companion, and I quote, our fathers, in their wisdom, knew that the foundations of liberty, fraternity, and equality must be universal education controlled by the government. There was great patriotic fervor leading up to the Spanish-American War. Government officials required people to stand when the flag passed by. On April 22, 1898, the day after the U.S. declared war on Spain, a New York State Senate Bill 556 required all children in government schools to salute the flag. The state created the Manual of Patriotism, offering five possible patriotic pledges. In 1939, the U.S. Flag Association acknowledged Bellamy as the author of the original pledge, Bellamy the Socialist. On August 20, 1953, the Supreme Council of the Knights of Columbus adopted a resolution urging the addition of the phrase under God and submitted it to the President, the Vice President, and the Speaker of the House of Representatives and to each member of Congress. President Eisenhower signed the edict for the addition of the phrase on June 14, 1954. The Jehovah Witnesses, the Amish, and others who take the Bible seriously do not believe in earthly allegiances, participate in secular government, vote, or hold office. They argue, as do specific scriptures, that saluting the flag and particularly reciting oaths of any kind are a form of idolatry. The group filed suit in a federal court in the late 1930s. School authorities frequently expelled or punished the children of Jehovah's Witnesses when these children refused to comply. In 1940, the Supreme Court agreed with a Pennsylvania law that required the recitation of the pledge in all public schools. Possibly one could view this as a dogma in the gradual establishment of secularism. The court, quite illegally, declared that Jehovah's Witnesses would have to comply. The court allowed no exemptions. The witnesses had lost the case, yet their actions outraged millions of Americans, causing outbreaks of violence against Jehovah's Witnesses. In Richmond, Virginia, the police chief gathered a group of witnesses together, required them to drink castor oil, and then marched them through the street before running them out of town. A local veterans group in Jackson, Mississippi, drove Jehovah's Witnesses from their homes. An angry mob in Nebraska castrated a Jehovah's Witness. In Rockville, Maryland, the police assisted locals in burning down a church. The same thing occurred in Kennebunk, Maine, where citizens burned a local Kingdom Hall to the ground. School officials increased their persecution of Jehovah's Witnesses, including threatening the children with imprisonment. The Justice Department received hundreds of complaints. In the early 1940s, the U.S., on the verge of entering yet another war, felt it was especially important to goad the populace into a patriotic frenzy so that young men would offer themselves as cannon fodder and the general population would support them in those militaristic efforts. Many states, therefore, imposed laws that required children to recite daily the pledge and salute the flag. However, in 1943, because of the persecution and violence against citizens due to religious beliefs, the courts reversed its decision on grounds of free exercise. Numerous states attempted to pass legislation requiring the recitation of the pledge shortly after September 11, 2001. Minnesota's governor at the time, Jesse Ventura, vetoed the bill as unconstitutional. The obedience-trained citizens of Minnesota criticized him for his decision. The required recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance, whether it be implied or legally sanctioned, is problematic on several levels, not the least of which is Constitution. The Constitution, ratified by the people, took divine right away from kings and despots and made the people sovereign. For the first time in history, this turned the reins of power on its head and made the government responsible to the people, not the other way around. The flag represents the government that we hired to carry out its responsibilities as defined in the Constitution, together with the restrictions in its scope that the founders provided with the Bill of Rights. This form of government was a true gift to we the people, albeit one which we have yet to fully embrace and enact. Part of this is due to the subtle but deliberate and persistent manipulations of the public psyche. In truth, the people do not owe automatic, unthinking allegiance and obedience to the government, so much as the government owes to the people accountability for its actions. The schools and other entities have indoctrinated the populace so that we almost mindlessly parrot the words of the pledge, go through the motions implied by our understanding of it without even thinking about the potential consequences of our unquestioning compliance. And most of us have no idea that this was all a socialistic operation. In the entire progress of socializing and secularizing this nation following the first socialistic revolution from 1861 to 1865, the watershed event that forever changed our government. We're going to a break in a short while. I will take calls after the break at 800-313-9443. Remember, Leo Tolstoy said when writing to a friend, and I quote, "The truth is that the state is a conspiracy designed not only to exploit, but above all, to corrupt its citizens. Henceforth, I shall never serve any government anywhere," unquote. So, the next time that you are required or asked to pledge allegiance, pledge obedience to your government, think, why am I doing this? Don't they owe us responsibility? Aren't they working for us? What the heck happened? Who switched all of this around? Who changed the position where we are subservient and they are the masters? Okay, we're going for a break. We'll be back, and you may call in after a word from our sponsors. And I'm back. I just love that song. It's called Peace. Steve Dorr wrote it, and it just relaxes me. Okay, we do have a caller on the line. Lark, you're on.
Deanna, are you reading from your upcoming book?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. I want to help you publish that book, by the way. Keep that in mind.
I have some, I'm self-publishing, because I actually had a publisher, but We had a disagreement. He wanted me to take stuff out, and I wanted to take stuff in.
I understand precisely what you're saying, but my offer still stands.
Well, thank you.
You know, Deanna, I've been listening to your reading from this work. It's been a very profound experience because many people today, as you know, just really do not know the history of their own country. And I can say that's been true of myself. I'm constantly discovering new threads of inquiry about our history. But, you know, I was doing some readings yesterday about Pavlov's experiments with dogs using a metronome to measure response,
right,
and how that influenced rock and roll music and how it actually forced its listeners to a state of exhaustion,
right,
where they were willingly led in the direction, in various directions. And the same can be said of Pythagoras' theory regarding music of the spheres,
right,
which was readily adopted by Freemasons, as you understand, in the higher ranks.
Right.
But, you know, it's pretty astonishing the kinds of things that you were saying about the Pledge of Allegiance, because I remember in school, perhaps you did as well, how rather uncomfortable that felt for whatever reason. Did you feel that when you were in school?
I was kind of I was different than a lot of other kids. I think I was a rebellious person. I was somewhat compliant, but I always asked questions. Well, why is it done this way, and why can't we do this? And, you know, I was always the one that was thinking outside of the envelope, perhaps.
Well, are you old enough to remember when, prayers were? Well, I should rephrase my question. did your classrooms, and when you went to public school, not only recite the pledge, but did they also have a prayer?
No.
Because we did early on when I was in elementary school, but later on it morphed into the so-called silent prayer or the moment of silence.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an issue with prayers in school because remember that your teacher is a government employee. And so there's two sides of that issue, and we don't have time to really elaborate on that. But in fact, we're out of time. What happened? What happened to our time? thank you, Lark, for calling, and thank you, listeners, for listening today. And we'll see you tomorrow. We won't see you, but hopefully you'll be back and listen. Thank you. Bye-bye.